Well, here's a question for you. What do you like and why do you like it? Your favorite color, the movie you just watched, that big gulp of orange sherbet. What is it that you liked and why? We've got two people here who are critically concerned with both all these questions. Nolan Gasser is a recognized composer, pianist, and musicologist, and most notably the architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project and the company's chief musicologist from its founding back in 1999. Nolan, welcome back. So nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's great to be here.
Tom Vanderbilt takes a deep dive into this world with his latest book. You may also like Taste in an Endless Age of Endless Choice. Tom's previous book took a similar intensive look at traffic and how we drive. He spoke about it on this program in 2008. Tom, welcome back to you.
Great to be here, Steve. Thanks.
And Nolan, you were here back in 2009, too.
Exactly right.
Well, you come right out and say it in here, Tom, trying to explain or understand any one person's particular tastes, including one's own, is always going to be maddeningly elusive. So if it's so elusive, why write a book about it?
I guess to try to come to terms with that very question. This is something, I mean, just thinking of Pandora since Nolan is here, I mean, this is something where I would listen to Pandora and I would sort of do the thumbs up, thumbs down. I think they have 50 billion of those when I was there. And wondering, you know, why was I doing that? And then what happened when I did, you know, pressed a thumb up or thumb down? Where did that information go? And one funny thing at Pandora they told me that kind of speaks to what you're talking about, the elusiveness, is they were sort of wondering, maybe we should try to figure out exactly why people are thumbing up or thumbing down a song. So it was sort of an A-B test. They did a little trial and put a box where you could explain, here's why I didn't like that song. But they said the answers they got were so insanely varied. I love the song because it was the first song at my daughter's wedding. I hate the song because, you know, blah, blah, blah. They could do nothing with it. Algorithmically, mathematically, it was sort of useless information. So they closed that feature and just went back to the thumbs.
Well, Nolan, you've been studying this for a while. What have you learned about what kind of music we like and why we like it? In 20 words or less.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, all I can really say is from my standpoint, what I was really interested in trying to make happen with the Music Genome Project is to take what we can say sort of objectively about music. What's going on under the hood about a song? What are those musicological elements of melody and harmony and rhythm and form that we can actually be objective and quantify? And if we can understand how those elements in isolation and in collection can interact with what people like, we can maybe begin to, if not explain why, we can be able to make correlations between songs. As to why they like it, it really indeed is a very complex sort of topic. It really relates to our personality, our culture, our subculture. So I'm not so sure that I can tell you why somebody mm-hmm. likes a particular song in 20 words. I think it really is a collection of a bunch of factors. But the Music Genome Project really was trying to dive into what are those musicological elements that relate to what we like.
How successful were you in your estimation?
Well,
and can you be successful at trying to do what you were doing?
I would say that it certainly has been a nice success. I think there, even in the 16 years since we got started and in the 12 years since Pandora got started, there's been a lot of competition. Other sort of, you know, companies trying to create an algorithm for matching personal tastes. And I think the success that Pandora has and continues to have does relate to the fact that by taking this very detailed look at the intrinsic aspect of a song, analyzed by a trained musician along hundreds of attributes, this very detailed approach does explain why Pandora is so successful, why we have 80 million people using it each month on a regular basis. If it didn't work, if it was just because we created nice playlists, I don't think it would be as successful.
Tom, are we better off for all of this, for having our tastes dictated to us in some ways here? And what are we missing by going this route?
I mean, there is this danger of what's been called the filter bubble, but I mean, that sort of is what taste is. We've always tried to restrict our input because of some sort of thing. But I think, you know, in this age of just endless choice, I mean, you can, a smartphone in your pocket has virtually the world's musical library.
People have a hard time dealing with this, don't they? It's like, as you've written, every song ever recorded is sort of at your fingertips at some point.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Pollan wrote this book called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And if you're a musical omnivore and you love to listen, you have that same dilemma. How much mental energy do you have in the course of the day to figure out what to listen to? So as Tim Westergren, the founder of Pandora, said to me, sort of jokingly, you know, we allow the middle-aged man to get back into the game of listening to music. Because I said, listen, I have a kid. I can't go to record stores anymore and hunt through bins and try to figure out what to listen
to. Like the good old days.
So thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. And what did he say about that? What's left there?
I mean, there's a lot left. I mean, one thing that just another anecdote that sticks in my mind was that he said in the early days there was a suggestion made, what if we just played music for people without any information shown?
Yes, I was going to ask about
what
that.
Was playing, and just tried to, you know, sort of expose people to new stuff they had never heard without expectation, without preconception. And he told me that the idea was deemed stupid, but you know, it is an open question because there are things that you come across on television, for example, in a VW commercial when they began playing the Nick Drake song Pink Moon. Mm-hmm. Nick Drake was this obscure English, you know, musician from the early 70s that was never big here and had been totally forgotten about. Suddenly, you know, people are running to the internet. You know, who's Nick Drake? What's this song? So mm-hmm. without knowing anything about it, they just had the chance to hear it. Whereas a lot of us have these built-in filters, I think, that would prevent us from ever getting to something like, you know, kind of soft English folk music mm-hmm. from the early 1970s that was obscure by this guy who had an overdose. And there's a lot of reasons they would say no to that music. But when they were just had the chance to hear it without preconception, it turned out they actually liked it.
And the same applies to food, you write in the book. If you change the coloring of certain food, you give people white wine but pour a little red dye into it, sometimes they're confused about – they like something they didn't think they were going to like.
Yeah, there's an old saying, the first taste is with the eyes. I mean, I think the first taste is really with the brain, and it probably applies to music as well. If I tell you I'm going to play something for you, you're going to have a preconception of what I've told you, which might, yeah. you know, again, turn you off from that.
Nolan, I get the sense that, again, in a world of endless choice, that many people just crave the idea of having some boundaries, some sort of more limited scope for where their selections might come from, because the idea of picking from everything is just too overwhelming.
Right. Well, this in many ways is what we sort of started with in creating internet radio, as opposed to just sort of an all-you-can-eat thing, which has obviously become very much the standard. And so Pandora is now transitioning. We are going to go into a model where you can sort of request songs on demand. But it is that overwhelming phenomenon. In some ways, it's very grand. In some ways, it can be very limiting. If you walk into a record store, this was our thinking way back in the beginning. You know, back in 1999, you'd walk in and you'd see, you know, four albums by Whitney Houston and Michael Jackson or whatever it would be, Madonna, yeah. and all this great music, Nick Drake and so forth, would be buried in the bins. So it really kind of cuts both ways. But, I think, just in terms of the ability to find music that you otherwise wouldn't. What Pandora it does actually provide, as Tom was saying, you know, some limited sort of descriptions of the music, but these in many ways are kind of watered down in terms of the actual nuanced detail that the Music Genome Project comes up with. And people, I think, in my discussions, often would love to go even further afield, like the ability to be able to go from, you know, John Coltrane into, you know, if I love John Coltrane, what would I love in bluegrass? Mm-hmm. Or if I'm a big you know, fan of Eric Clapton, what would I love in, you know, in classical?
So the boundaries are breaking down?
Well, I think that we have that interest now that we have access to really, you know, the entire recorded output and all of these, you know, sort of companies like Spotify and so forth. We really can have an all-you-can-eat. So we do need boundaries, but if we can be guided, if we can have our hands held to navigate the entire space, I think that would be a very desirable thing for a lot of people.
Tom, how did you get started in this whole notion of taste and why we like what we like? Because I don't even think about it. I just know what I like and know what I don't like.
Yeah, I mean, like many great intellectual quests, it was a question from a four-year-old who my daughter who asked me one day on the way to school, "What's your favorite color?"
What's your favorite color? That's how you begin
age,
the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, kids of that age are obsessed with favorites. I think they're trying to sort of figure out who they are, and they're looking for quick, easily identifiable tokens of kind of identity. So I gave her the answer blue, and that's a pretty predictable choice. It's the most popular color, especially among men. It's been that way for 100 years since people have been asking this question. But I sort of wondered, you know, was blue actually my favorite color? And if it was, exactly why?
Yeah.
So this led me to the office of Stephen Palmer at University of California, Berkeley, who has this interesting theory called ecological valence, which says basically that we like the colors most of the things we like the most. So our associations with blue are pretty positive. The blue skies, water, all sorts of good things. So we basically like that we're exposed to these things. We have good feelings about them. We turn out to like the color. That's his theory. I find it pretty interesting.
Yeah. Nolan, I'm wondering how you got started at Pandora to begin with.
Well, it was a great accident. I was at Stanford. I was in the last stages of completing my PhD in Renaissance musicology, not the first thing you'd think of in starting a new music technology company. And I got a sort of a random email from Tim looking for people to help analyze music for a new music technology company. And this, you know, I hadn't even really seen music and technology much put together. And I was thinking I was going for a career in academia, but I responded because I do have a background in a wide variety of music. I've always been pretty eclectic as a pianist and as a composer. And next thing I knew, I was offered the job to sort of run the entire music operation.
The job was to do what at that point?
Well, I think initially the call was to, because there was very early sort of stage version, very sort of simple version of what this sort of music genome project would be. I think that the founders, you know, came up with the idea almost sort of as a bit of a pun on, you know, because this was the age where the Human Genome Project was all the rage, right around, you know, this time. And so it sounded nice to create a sort of a music genome project, but what it would actually be was, I think, not terribly clear. And so Tim said to me, you know, why don't you take this idea and really kind of expand it? So I actually had to go to Milan for research on my doctorate. And I took my, you know, my Mac computer and I just sat in the library and thought deeply about how would we go about taking sort of a genomic approach to music. And so I think I fleshed it out in a way that the founders really didn't conceive of at the start.
When you were developing the Genome Project, the central idea was to help, you know, both listeners learn about new music and get lesser known artists exposure. What's the process of matching artists to listener like, Nolan? How does that work?
Right. Well, this, when I first met Tim, we actually sat down and had this very kind of morally grounded conversation. There was this crisis that we felt was in the music industry. Certainly Tim felt that. He'd been sort of a struggling rock artist and had just found this very frustrating experience of trying to reach an audience that he couldn't get access to. And, of course, he read many articles. There was an article in the New York Times about Amy Mann, who had been dumped by her label and just couldn't get arrested, even though she had many hits prior.
Who's going to be here for the middle of the Matt Fest.
Yeah. Wonderful, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the idea of being able to connect artists with audiences and vice versa was really and still is the grounding sort of philosophy that undergirds what we're trying to do there. And so the idea was to, you know, not base it on this sort of metadata information about who scored a hit, who's with what label, you know, where they're from, what genre they're in, really. What's going on in this very, you know, intrinsic way. And, you know, because when people experience music, there's a lot of factors as we're talking about. There's what time of day it is, what mood we're in, you know, if we're exercising, if we want to go to bed. But, you know, there are some, you know, ingrained aspects about musical sort of discourse that resonate with us. So if we could be objective about this and categorize those qualities and quantify them, it really was this moral connection that we could make between these two. And there's no doubt, as you know, many anecdotes have shown, that people discover music that they never knew existed that now can be their favorites.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to perfect that process?
Well, over 8 years, I guess. I mean, there are 6 genomes at Pandora. We started off with our main genome, which is the pop rock R&B kind of genome. And then
right.
We moved into jazz. And as we actually built these out, we began to learn more and more. So we went back and sort of refigured the earlier ones. And by the time we got to classical in 2006 or 7, we really kind of had it down. And there are about, you know, almost 500 genes in the classical genome. So lots of things to quantify.
And the key for you has been to focus on those aspects of music that you can quantify objectively, right?
Right. Well, the company has, in the years since, has certainly expanded its purview about what it is, you know, as Tom is certainly well aware.
Yeah.
It's not just those intrinsic musicological elements. It has to do, you know, there are social elements, you know, what social media has to, its role in that. And certainly, you know, what other people like, you know, by virtue of those 50 billion thumbs up, Pandora knows a lot about, you know, if you create a Drake station, you know, what are all the other songs that have been thumbed up by virtue of that? So we can channel you towards those. But at the end of the day, what's going on in that sort of musicological realm still holds sway.
You know, Tom, you wrote this in the book. We are faced with an ever-increasing amount of things to figure out whether we like or dislike. And yet at the same time, there are fewer overarching rules and standards to go by in helping one decide. Do there need to be rules and standards?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, back in the 1950s, you had, you know, something like the Book of the Month Club. They would sort of tell you, you know, here's what you should read this month. This is the stuff. Now, people are much more kind of democratic about it. It's more of a process of discovery. But it does raise this, you know, kind of open question of where does sort of the question of quality fit into that. It's become very hard to say something is good or bad in this kind of landscape. And I think there are, you know, I think a lot of us, as I said before, we've become omnivores and we're kind of swimming out there looking for, you know, things. But I mean, David Hume was worried about this 200 years ago.
That's
haven't
right.
come that much closer to
exactly.
solving it. And it's actually even more complicated now. I find myself wondering why I'm liking a Facebook page, then I'm liking someone's reply to my comment, and do they like what I've replied? You know, it's just this endless. We're expressing so many sort of bits of feedback every day, and I wonder, you know, how much time I even have to think about how much did I really like that?
It's just this is all so interesting. I should point out that both our guests will be speaking this evening at the Kansas City Public Library. Tom Vanderbilt speaks at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch. Nolan Gasser follows him at 7:15. This is all part of the Middle of the Map Fest, and tickets you can go to middleofthemapfest.com. Nolan Gasser, again, a pianist, a recognized composer, architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project. Tom Vanderbilt, his latest book, You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. And you guys have been great. We could talk about this for a very long time. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.